time because that doesn't take as much work.
Right.
So the big guys get off the hook. They get a free pass, and the rest of us do not. Going back to your earlier caller talking about the Swedish corporations dissing him and American workers in general. Well, that's what American companies do when they go to Vietnam and everywhere else. I mean, this is not unusual behavior. If you can make solidarity with the Swedish workforce, if you can get something going on where you have interplay between the various levels of minions, then you have a better bargaining position. You can say, you know, you're doing this at home.
You're going to get cut off. I accidentally, you called in way too late. I really appreciate you, Ty. Thank you for being my engineer. And thank you, Portland, for allowing me to express my ideas and let you express yours. Until next time in 2 weeks on the 15th, and I do have a guest that day, thank you all for being here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Please become a member. We need you.
You have some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s, standing on your head. Yow!
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Spencer Graves of KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Today on Sprouts, Maria Stefan will discuss her work with Erica Chenoweth, comparing the relative effectiveness of violence and nonviolence. Other researchers have studied either violence or nonviolence. Chenoweth and Stefan are, from what I know, the international experts studying their relative effectiveness. Their book on why civil resistance works appeared in 2011. Not coincidentally, Chenoweth joined the Harvard faculty in 2018. Maria earned a PhD in law and diplomacy from the Fletcher School, then joined the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. From there, she took a position with the U.S. State Department as the lead foreign affairs officer for the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations before joining the U.S. Institute of Peace. She is currently co-lead and chief organizer with the Horizons Project, which serves as an organizing platform dedicated to strengthening multiracial democracy in the U.S. and globally. Maria, what are the most important things you want to communicate to our audience?
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Spencer, and thanks for inviting me to join your program. It's good to be with you all today. I think the main message, you know, every day we wake up and it seems like we're barraged with a series of crises here in the United States and around the world. You know, whether it's the rise in threats and political violence in the United States, kind of the resurgence of authoritarianism, we have the standard bearer of one of our main political parties promising to be a dictator on day one if reelected. We have recurrence of police brutality that's undermining kind of the basic human rights and civil liberties of Black Americans in this country. So there are a lot of challenges internationally. I'm sure we're all seized with the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, in the war between Israel and Hamas. We're following the continued bloodshed and humanitarian crisis in Sudan that has displaced, I believe, around 3 million people. We're seeing 2 years after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, a continuation of war and suffering there, you know, and all the environmental challenges, the climate crisis. So it seems, you know, that we're being hit on all sides. And something that we discuss a lot at the Horizons Project, which is focused on strengthening democracy here at home and also internationally, is the need to balance urgency with hope and agency. And so we need to continue to be seized with the reality of these challenges in the United States and internationally, these interconnected challenges, while at the same time going back to the fundamentals that we are capable of bringing about change. Any positive change in this country has come about as the result of people coming together across difference and using different forms of nonviolent action to challenge injustices and to bring about a better society and a better world. And so I think returning to some of those fundamentals, that nonviolent action, which is something I've focused on for about three decades, I still believe that nonviolent action is the most powerful force available to humankind.
What about your work with Chenoweth?
Arifa and I spent several years collecting data on all the known major violent and nonviolent campaigns from 1900 up, you know, through the century. These were maximalist campaigns. So these were major political campaigns challenging incumbent regimes and foreign military occupations. And so we were, you know, interested in which form of resistance were the primacy of tactics were either violent or nonviolent, which campaigns had been more effective. And to cut a long story short, the major nonviolent campaigns were twice as successful as the armed insurgencies, succeeding about twice as often. The main reason for that was that the nonviolent campaigns attracted significantly higher and more diverse participation, were more likely to prompt loyalty shifts in the regime's key pillars of support, and were able to exert pressure and leverage much more effectively than the armed insurgencies. And the other part of the research, as you noted, Spencer, is that we found a very strong correlation between nonviolent resistance and democratization. As you noted, in about the 25% of campaigns where the violent insurgency was successful, so think about in northern Vietnam, think about Maoist China, Algeria, those campaigns were successful by our definition, but almost never, in less than, I believe, 3% of the cases, did the armed insurgencies then pave the way to a democracy. So often the regimes that emerged were more tyrannical, dictatorial, and often there was a relapse back into civil war following the success of armed insurgencies. So we found, the bottom line is that we found that not only were the nonviolent campaigns much more effective than the armed insurgencies in achieving their major goals, they were also much more likely to result in democratic and peaceful societies.
How was Israel fit in that pattern?
So, one interesting thing in my research, both in my dissertation and in the book Civilian Jihad, which is on the history of nonviolent struggle in the greater Middle East, and then also one of the chapters in Why Civil Resistance Works, was about the first Palestinian Intifada. So I was very interested as a scholar of civil resistance in when and why self-determination struggles succeeded. So I was very interested in kind of comparing Palestine, East Timor, and Kosovo. And so, you know, so one interesting thing to note, an important thing I think to note in this context, as this horrific tragedy continues to unfold in Gaza following the terrible Hamas attack on October 7th, is that there is actually a long history of Palestinian nonviolent resistance against the Israeli occupation. And we can lose sight of that, especially in moments like this. And I often would hear people asking, well, where's the Palestinian Gandhi? If only there were Palestinian Gandhis. And, you know, in fact, we know that there have been many Palestinian Gandhis. And in the leading proponents of nonviolent resistance have often been those who have been arrested, detained, deported, even assassinated. And so I, you know, was particularly interested in the first Palestinian intifada, which was the uprising against the Israeli occupation in the late 1980s. And I was interested in that struggle, not because it was wholly successful. In our data set in why civil resistance work, the first intifada is coded as a partial success, meaning it paved the way to the negotiations and the Oslo peace accords, but it did not achieve meaningful self-determination, much less Palestinian statehood. But I was interested in that period of time, especially the first 18 months of the first intifada, because I believe Palestinians achieved more in advancing their self-determination struggle during that 18-month period when the primacy of tactics used were protests, boycotts, strikes, creating parallel education systems, victory gardens. So this whole range of nonviolent actions that involved every segment of Palestinian society. It was led by Palestinians in the occupied territories, not by the PLO on the outside that had been relying for decades on armed attacks and terrorism. This was an uprising led by Palestinians living under occupation. And I was very interested in the organization of the first intifada, how the main factions came together to create a united national leadership, how they disseminated leaflets or bayonets that described the daily tactics of the intifada, the massively participatory nature. So I think it's important to, even in this period, to recall that there is this history. The context has changed a lot since that time period. And the Oslo Accords, which brought to power, incidentally, the Oslo Accords brought to power a Palestinian authority that had been operating outside of the occupied territory. So those who were leading the first intifada, this remarkable uprising, were sidelined. They were not the lead negotiators. And those who were representing Palestinians were those who had been fighting with armed insurgency on the outside for many, many years. And that became the Palestinian Authority. And so now the challenge is the Israeli bombardment following the very horrific Hamas action on October 7th has been disproportionate. 30,000 people have died, including 12,000 at least children, Palestinian children. And so the response is terrible. And so now the question becomes, what is the future? Like, how is it possible to reimagine a strategy of collective liberation and self-determination in this context? And I do still believe, notwithstanding all that is happening right now, that this continues to be the only way out of this terrible situation and the only way to achieve peace with justice for both peoples on both sides of the Green Line. And that is through nonviolent action and civil resistance. And that resistance has to include Palestinians inside the occupied territories, Israelis inside Israel and Palestinian citizens of Israel, and then people who are in other countries like the United States, whose government is firmly backing the occupation and backing a right-wing government right now. And so that continues for me to remain the main and possibility for the situation over there.
Talk about Mubarak Awad.
Mubarak Awad, Palestinian American, who played a very active role in the lead up to and during the first Palestinian Intifada, a leading proponent of nonviolence. He, you know, was conducting trainings in nonviolence in the territories, was involved in various nonviolent actions, and he was arrested and eventually deported by the Israeli government, you know, during that period of time. And so Mubarak now as the founder, co-founder of Nonviolence International, has been very focused on strengthening nonviolence amongst Palestinians and raising awareness of what is happening over there, the dynamics of the occupation. I did interviews on both sides of the Green Line while writing my dissertation. And so I remember interviewing retired Israeli generals, IDF, Israeli Defense Force generals, and one in particular, you know, one of his responses when we were talking about what made the First Intifada different compared to other periods of Palestinian resistance. And he acknowledged that what was different was the mass participation. Everyone was participating, you know, women, children, professionals, workers, everybody was in. And he said, yeah, and we don't do Gandhi well. Meaning the Israeli government and IDF had a difficult time responding to the mass participation in the uprising. And so, yes, the response was predictably repressive with all the arrests, deportations, imprisonment, killings that happened during that time. But I would note that over the course of the First Intifada, there was coverage. It was very clear that this was, you know, an unarmed civilian population challenging a military occupation. And so there was a lot of media coverage. People may not know that there were a number of Israeli Jews who were actively participating in the campaigns of the First Intifada, so especially in the town of Beit Zahor. So there were joint Israeli-Palestinian actions. A number of American diaspora members came over, so there was a lot of solidarity action. For the very first time, when the news was covering the kind of disproportionate response and the repressive reaction of the Israeli government under then Shamir to the uprising, for the very first time, the United States withheld its veto in the United Nations when there was a resolution condemning the Israeli response. That was the first time that had happened. And so it's worth thinking about, you know, what would have prompted that response, that reaction, and you know, to the difference of things, you know, events that transpire before and after. So, you know, that's the thing. When you study nonviolent resistance, the sad truth is that nonviolent kind of movements are almost always responded to with violence. It's like one of the most predictable things. But depending on what the movement itself does, is it able to maintain resilience, discipline, strategic focus? Is it able to maintain mass participation? That's what determines whether the violence backfires against the perpetrators, meaning they lose support, they lose the moral high ground because of their response, or whether that doesn't happen and people are paralyzed or they do nothing in response. And so anyway, so I think that period, you know, of the Palestinian struggle continues to be very instructive.
How did you meet Erica Chenoweth?
Yeah, so I, you know, I was at that time working at the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, which is an international nonprofit organization that is dedicated to developing, disseminating knowledge, know-how about strategic nonviolent action. You know, I joined ICNC after wrapping up my dissertation, and I was the director of educational initiatives during that time. And so one of the very early convenings that we hosted was a meeting in Colorado to talk about how educators and scholars are researching and teaching about nonviolent action. So it was a meeting. I remember it was called People, Power, and Pedagogy. And Erica was there. And I remember very, like, you know, fortuitously and not planned at all, we were roommates. And so we ended up spending a lot of time at night talking about, like, well, you know, how often is nonviolent resistance really successful? You have all these classic cases of, like, you know, Indian independence movement and the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa and the Chilean movement that ousted Pinochet and the U.S. civil rights movement and the Polish solidarity movement. So you have all these classic cases, but can nonviolent resistance really be effective in the most repressive environments? And is its track record really better than armed resistance? And the fact was, you know, nobody had attempted to systematically compare the two forms of resistance. So by the end of that gathering, basically on the back of a napkin, we had plotted out you know, the table of contents for what became Why Civil Resistance Worked.
You are listening to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Spencer Graves with KKFI Kansas City Community Radio, talking with Maria Stephan about her research into understanding the relative effectiveness of violence and nonviolence, and her work with the Horizons Project to strengthen multiracial democracy in the U.S. and globally.
What is the Horizons Project?
After working for decades on international issues, you know, I've been focusing, working with, you know, movements and activists all around the world who were fighting for rights, freedom, democracy, using civil resistance. You know, I had been studying authoritarianism, the dynamics of authoritarianism, how autocrats consolidate, maintain control, gut democratic institutions. And so having worked all these issues for so many years internationally, seeing what was happening in my own country, certainly authoritarianism did not begin with the Trump administration. We have a long history of authoritarianism in this country. You know, think about Jim Crow, the system of racial apartheid in the South. That was a very quintessential form of single party authoritarian rule that was at that time consolidated in the Democratic Party. Today, the authoritarian faction is consolidated in the Republican Party, and seeing like all the elements of the authoritarian playbook playing out in my backyard, I decided I needed to be able to focus more on what was happening in the United States. So I took a sabbatical from my work at the U.S. Institute of Peace, started to get involved with different democracy networks, peace building, bridge building networks, movements, groupings that were organizing under the Trump administration, where, you know, after the Muslim ban, you know, after the very anti-immigrant kind of sentiments, after, you know, all the things that were happening during that time period, the normalization of political violence and threats, you know, the announcement that, you know, if the election didn't go Trump's way, he would probably not recognize the results. So all these things that we know are part of the authoritarian playbook, you know, seeing that how focused it was in the United States, I needed to be able to focus much more on this. So the Horizons Project was being incubated at my colleague Julia Roy's old organization, Partners Global. Horizons was meant to be a platform to come together and bring different tools, perspectives, and approaches to address the crisis of democracy, the crisis of systemic racism, inequality, all these intersecting, reinforcing crises that we're facing using this variety of different tools and approaches. So that was kind of the impetus behind Horizons. We also very much bring in the international insights and perspectives. So not only what do we know about how authoritarians consolidate power, and you know, some of your listeners may be familiar with Protect Democracy's authoritarian playbook. It's a very useful guide that I commend to folks. I would also recommend to folks the online publication Just Security has developed an autocrat threat tracker for the U.S. So if you want to go into the very specifics of the kind of most significant threats to U.S. democracy in this moment and proposed responses and solutions, those two works, I think, are very, very helpful. So on a day-to-day basis, Spencer, we do a lot of organizing between different communities and constituencies. So we're working with movements, because the whole idea is like, whether you're working on racial justice, anti-poverty, reproductive rights, you know, environmental issues, all being affected by the attacks on democracy. So how can we build a movement of movements to be able to collectively respond? How can we bring in unlikely allies in the business sector, in the faith community, in the veterans community, in like, you know, professional associations? So a lot of our work is research, but also organizing across difference, across partisan ideology, across different sectors, to be able to stubbornly say no to authoritarianism in the U.S. and yes to a multiracial democracy. Just Security's autocratic threat tracker. I think it's just important to be aware of how, you know, institutions, democratic institutions are co-opted, are undermined, and all the things that we're seeing, the threats and political violence, the book bans, the anti-LGBTQ legislation, the anti-protester bills, the voter suppression that's happening at the state level. All of these things are part of a system, and there are ways to confront this system. So education about how authoritarianism functions, but then getting involved in organizing. I mean, for me, so much goes back to local, community, state, national, and eventually international organizing to be able to bring people together to address the challenges as they're playing out locally. And I can guarantee that the various components of the authoritarian playbook are probably happening in communities where, you know, your community is operating. So how do you find common cause, whether it's through church groupings, whether it's, you know, local community-based organizations? We need to be able to come together and strategize and prepare and train, because that is how we can get better at responding. One of the key findings from research is that training really matters. Training is important both to build skills. So, you know, how can we think about strategically sequencing nonviolent tactics? Can we think about the most likely scenarios to play out so that we can plan? What are the dialogue approaches to bring people together across difference? How do we call people in rather than calling them out? So there are very specific skills and tools that can be honed. And I think that's part of it, coming together, getting trained together, learning from other experiences. Protect Democracy is an organization, that a national organization that is focused on various attacks on democracy and authoritarianism in the U.S. It's trying to prevent the United States from backtracking and becoming autocratic. And so Protect Democracy, if you go to their website, they have a lot of useful resources. The Authoritarian Playbook, I find very helpful. I also find they now have the Authoritarian Playbook for 2025, which is basically taking the statements and proposed actions of, you know, not only Donald Trump and his closest advisors, what they've said they will do, and kind of have brought them together. Because the one thing when you focus on authoritarianism, one of the key lessons is that when an autocrat says they will do something, believe them. They will try to do it. So anyway, that's one of the resources that brings kind of different, you know, different kind of analyses and toolkits together. So that's Protect Democracy. The 22nd Century Initiative has been working with different movement organizations. They have a network meeting once a month that, again, brings people together from very different movements, very different states and parts of the country to come together around a shared analysis of what's happening and kind of how we can respond together. Race Forward, which is very focused on the nexus of racial justice and democracy. It's a question of how to build a movement of movements. I've been involved in the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative. There are different groupings and networks that regularly meet, strategize. So I'm thinking about the Trust Network, for example. This is a group of bridge building and peace building organizations that come together, highlight good things that are happening on the ground, different forms of different organization that is happening. They've been pioneering work on an early warning, early response system to address violence.
The Patriot Act makes it illegal to teach nonviolence to anyone designated as a terrorist by the U.S. State Department, according to the Supreme Court decision Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project. Talk about that.
I would just say, without being a lawyer or a legal expert, there absolutely has to be ways to provide training to groups in strategic nonviolent action and nonviolent responses. And this is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, probably the strongest finding in the, you know, systematic analysis that Erica and I did of the role of external actors vis-a-vis nonviolent movements. So the training, the preparation, the planning, learning from other experiences, is like the most effective way that outside actors can support nonviolent movement. So this is probably, and this is why the Horizons Project has been centering training so much and working with a cohort of trainers from across the US called the Growers Guild. These are civil resistors, these are organizers, these are conflict resolution people.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to Maria Stephan about her research in understanding the relative effectiveness of violence and nonviolence and her work with the Horizons Project to strengthen multiracial democracy. More on this is available at kkfi.org, then News and Public Affairs, then All Souls Forum, then Multiracial Democracy. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Spencer Graves with KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Is autism an epidemic? Or is it a superpower? Are you a little bit on the spectrum? Or are you hashtag actually autistic? I'm Kerry Stewart Lingle, host of NeuroEmergent. Join me from 11 a.m. to noon on the fourth Wednesday of every month to explore neurodiversity in the Pacific Northwest and beyond, right here on KBOO Community Radio.
Today on Wings, the Beijing agenda today.
The high-level meeting of the General Assembly on the 30th anniversary of the Fourth World Conference on Women is called to order.